All right, thank you, and thanks for coming out on a bit of a toasty day for Coos County, for sure. It's always great to be here. I'm a pre-stater, I think is what you call it, Jason, right? Born and bred here in New Hampshire, so it's always great to come back here, even though right now I live in Taxachusetts, which is a little bit closer to, than Virginia, where I really was before. So just a brief outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about American foreign policy, particularly as it relates to Ukraine. But I'm going to not start with Ukraine, because I think it's important to embed our discussion of Ukraine in light of American foreign policy more broadly. So let's start with ends, right? Anybody heard of Karl von Clausewitz? Clausewitz? Yeah, Pete, I know, heard it at West Point. You know, Clausewitz talks about the importance of thinking about war as being politics by other means, right? That war serves the ends of the state or of the society, not it being an act alone or disconnected from politics. And so I want to start with ends, because if you just said, like, hey, should the United States intervene in Ukraine, my question as an international relations scholar, a realist, someone who thinks about political economy a lot is, well, it all depends, right? That's the appropriate question to have here, because you have to do a cost-benefit analysis in which you look at ends, ways, and means. So what are the ends as I see it? What are our vital national interests? Well, I think the first of these is natural, and it drives me nuts when people don't say this first, right? Of course we want to think about our territorial integrity, right? Our homeland security, our safety here at home. That seems to be the most logical reason why you would have a foreign policy in the first place, is to protect yourself against the potential for foreign aggression in the same way in which the individual right of self-defense and public safety is meant to protect against the potential for internal aggression. So that's the first national interest. I think you could also make a case that the conditions of our economic prosperity are also an important national interest. Again, I'm not saying that the government's role is to provide for economic prosperity. That's up to us in civil society. Government doesn't create wealth, right? But you could imagine that it's important for our national interest, especially for that first one, to have access, for example, to the blue water, right? To be able to protect our ability to trade with other societies, to trade with individuals in other places, and also to make sure that we have access to strategic choke points, okay? And then also, with the rise of technology, the role of space, so protecting our satellite capabilities in space is important as a condition of our economic prosperity. And then thirdly, particularly for us that are, those of us who are classical liberals or libertarians, it is our particular Republican form of constitutional government here at home. And you might ask yourself, well, how could that be threatened absent being, you know, the first being threatened? Well, you could imagine election tampering by foreign countries. I bet my colleague Bob Wright has heard of Citizen Genet as a historian. You know, this is someone roaming around the United States, particularly, I think, Philadelphia, trying to get the United States into a war with the UK or with the British back in the, I think it was the 1790s. So you can imagine these being threats to our constitutional order here at home. But those are our basic vital national interests. Now, I'll just say this really briefly. I don't think that the pursuit of the national interest is an amoral issue, right? It's not as if there's an amoralism to foreign policy. Instead, I think that there is moral dignity in the government protecting those vital national interests, right? The interests that are important for citizens who have joined together or created the state or maintained an allegiance to the state, right? In other words, if you have a kind of Lockean framework for how we get to the state in some fashion, or even a more instrumental framework, which is to suggest that simply that the state matters for doing certain tasks that we cannot do individually as well, then there's a moral dignity in the state engaging in activities that lead to meeting those national interests. But when the state goes beyond that, it's not that there's an issue of amoralism there either, it's that the state is acting actually immorally. So when the government is coercing you to provide funds for an activity abroad that does not connect to our national interest, that's an act of government that we should not be supportive of, because it's not consistent with the reason why we might have a state in the first place. Again, assuming that you're not an anarcho-capitalist, and I don't assume that here at Porkfest, but you could understand the argument, I think, if you're a minarchist or a minimal state classical libertarian, classical liberal. So again, I think there's moral dignity in following the national interest as a North Star. But foreign policy guided by other ends, say kind of values disconnected from our national interest, is where we go off the rails. And unfortunately, our foreign policy over the last 30 years has really gone off the rails. Now, you could argue we went off the rails in 1898. I'm open to that idea. But it's really gone off the rails over the last 30 years. Okay, so if we're going to engage in foreign policy, or what we might term grand strategy, which is how you support your foreign policy with military means, we have to ask ourselves, what are the key considerations you'd want to think about? And that's because I would argue that there's no universal one-size-fits-all approach to foreign policy. It depends, right? There are foreign policies that are always wrong from a classical liberal or realist or restraint framework, okay? But there is not a single comprehensive foreign policy across all time and place. So, for example, the United States should have a very different foreign policy when our country was founded, right? We needed the French alliance in order to protect our attempt to become an independent nation. You could argue that, like, Prussia in the 1860s on the plains of Northern Europe needed a very different approach to grand strategy than a country like ours, which is a big island, it's a continental-sized island with two big moats, okay, and nuclear weapons, right? So again, context matters a lot to grand strategy. So I am not someone who thinks we should always have the same grand strategy no matter where we live or what's going on in the world. And I'm very friendly to, for example, non-interventionism as a kind of instinct, but there may be times where you want to have something like an alliance with France in the 1780s, for example. That was a good time to have that sort of alliance. So what are some things we'd want to think about? Well, one important thing to think about is the global balance of power. So we live in an anarchic world internationally in which there's no 911, as John Mearsheimer talks about. So that means that it's going to be what we call a self-help system, a system in which you're going to have to protect yourself because there's no one else that's going to ride to the rescue, right? If, for example, the British try to storm our capital and burn our capital, there's no one to call, right? There's no 911 to say, hey, United Nations, can you help, right? And we wouldn't want that. Thank goodness we don't have that. So that means that I think that it's important to have a strong national defense. Now, what that means, I think we could talk about. But I think it's important that that's a context. The fact that we live in this anarchic world matters a lot. Another thing that matters is what we call the offense-defense balance. In other words, is it easy to aggress or is it hard to aggress based on the nature of technology at the time? So, unfortunately, the world in 1914 thought it was easy to aggress, but it was really hard to go on the offensive and gain territory, which is why it ended in trench warfare. Whereas in 1939, people thought it was hard to aggress, and because of the nature of technology and some of the military initiatives that the Germans engaged in, it became easier. So that matters too, because if it's hard to aggress, you have less to worry about, and you may not need to have such a forward or aggressive defense than when it's easy to aggress. Now, we actually live in a very defensive dominant world, meaning it's hard to aggress, and that matters for the choices we should make. The nuclear revolution is probably the most critical feature of the balance of power. Namely, countries that have secure second strike nuclear capabilities, meaning that if another country even attacked us with nuclear weapons, we could still get ours off. That almost assures that first vital national interest. It's almost impossible to imagine the United States being attacked by a foreign country on our soil because of the fact that we can threaten them with nuclear annihilation. And that sobers people up a lot. So that's a huge thing, right? So you could argue like, hey, even if you argued, we needed to be in World War I, we needed to be in World War II because of the global balance of power. And you could say, hey, the nuclear revolution changes that. Once you have nuclear weapons, once you have a secure second strike capability, that changes the nature of the international system in a way that makes it less necessary to have some of the same concerns that have traditionally been part of international relations since Thucydides. And then lastly, economic and material power. Okay? If you're really economically successful, you can create a lot more military power with that economic power that you have. It's the golden goose. This is why Admiral Mike Mullen, when he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that the biggest national security threat to the United States was not Iran, China, terrorism, etc. It was our national debt and deficits. Because he argued that if you kill the golden goose, we're not going to be able to provide the type of security that we will on the, you know, in a world in which we're economically dominant. So your military power and your balance of military power matters. So for example, the fact that we are a gazillion trillion dollar economy, right? Not quite that high, but we are, you know, a massive economy relative to Russia means that we could produce a lot more we could produce a lot more military power at lower relative cost than Russia can. And that impacts the type of threat environment you're in. And so your grand strategy, your foreign policy, has to be related to that threat environment. That's what realism as a theory of international politics, or realpolitik as a theory of statecraft, brings to the table, an acknowledgement that that threat system and the balance of power matters a lot to what we should do in the world. Now, I mentioned geography, too, because amateurs don't talk about geography when it comes to warfare, okay? I mentioned my colleague Pete went to West Point. You guys talked a lot about geography, I'm sure, right? But it's not just at the tactical level, it's at the strategic level. If you're Prussia in the 1860s, or Germany in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, right, and onward, geography matters a lot, but it pinches because you're on the North European plains where it's easier to engage in military power, into project military power. We're a different kind of country, and our founders understood that we had a kind of like providential blessing that we were remote from the rest of the world, right? We had two big moats between us and the other great powers. We have friendly neighbors who are weak, right? No one thinks that Mexico or Canada are huge threats to our national security. We dominate the Western Hemisphere. And then the other thing, again, my friend John Mearsheimer talks about this a lot, is what's called the stopping power of water. It's hard to project power across flat surfaces, particularly oceans, okay? And that means you can target any type of, like, you know, Chinese armada well out at sea easily because you can't do what you could do in ground warfare, which is essentially kind of maneuver, okay? Something like bounding, okay? So the million-man swim is never happening, okay? Don't worry about that. When you watch Fox News or read the Wall Street Journal, they talk about the huge threat of China to our security. You're like, how are they getting here? Right? Where are they going to have military bases? And if they put them in Mexico, if they somehow formed an alliance with Mexico and then tried to have military bases, kind of like what some countries have done, like we've done abroad, well, we could prevent that pretty easily ahead of time as long as we have the will to do so. So geography is a huge constraint. There are also institutional constraints. I'm not going to go into that in much detail. But history matters too. Because of the history, for example, of Japanese imperialism, that makes it harder for Japan, for example, to grow in the same way the United States grew in its formation. And a big part of that is because of the power of nationalism. Nationalism makes it also very difficult to take and hold foreign peoples. And I saw that firsthand in Afghanistan, okay? It's really difficult to, even if you're well-intentioned, it's really difficult for the people to be like, yeah, you know, just do what you want here. Like, you're friendly. Great. People don't like to be ruled over by others. Hell, I don't even like to be ruled over by Washington. Okay? And then theories about the nature of the world are also important to how you think about grand strategy. So, for example, do you think it's always 1938? Because just about all the foreign policy established in Washington thinks it's 1938. Okay? Meaning that aggressors are always going to start knocking dominoes down, and the next thing you know, you're dealing with a million-man swim. Right? I mean, how many times do you hear the foreign policy establishment talk about 1938, Munich? The next thing you know, I mean, in the 90s, it was Slobodan Milosevic. Serbia was somehow going to do what? But people talked about it. No, then in the 2000s, it was rogue nations, dictators like Saddam Hussein, right? And then, you know, you're talking about Putin and Russia. Now, again, if you're Ukrainian, Russian aggression is a real danger to you, as we've seen. But it's not as if, even if Putin were successful in Ukraine, that instantly means that other dominoes are going to fall, right? Because again, remember what the balance of power teaches us. Western Europe is more populous and richer by huge margins compared to Russia, even leaving aside America, okay? Another thing that you might think about, is the world Manichaean? In other words, is the world divided into forces of good and forces of lightness? You see this all the time in the foreign policy debate. And in fact, you see it now when you hear Biden talk about autocracy versus democracy. That's what is the nature of the world is. It's between these two types of states. That is just poppycock, right? That is just naive thinking. The world is much more complicated than that. We know that. Another question is, do states balance against potential threats, or do they bandwagon? In other words, like, let's say that we left East Asia. We retrenched and came back to our homeland. Well, some people would say that means Japan and South Korea will bandwagon with China, and then we'll have a big problem. Others would say, no, that the way the world has worked since Thucydides 2,500 years ago is that states will balance against threats or aggressors. So again, like, these are the types of kind of questions that you should ask yourself that reflect on what type of foreign policy you're going to choose. Because if you say it's not always 1938, if you say the world is not Manichaean, it's much more complicated, if you think the balance of power matters and states balance, nationalism is important, and the United States isn't an indispensable nation in the sense that in order for something good to happen in the world, we have to be leading it, then you might choose a different grand strategy than someone who holds the opposite view. And the opposite view is basically the foreign policy establishment. So there are two fundamental approaches to grand strategy. Now again, you know, this is a simplification. That's what political scientists like me do. Okay, sure, you could carve up all the types of foreign policy approaches and say, there's 17 different types of snow, okay? But in reality, there's kind of two different approaches. One is the theory of primacy, which is the foreign policy establishment's view. It's the operating system of Washington for the last 30 years at least. And then there's restraint, which is the approach that I favor. So let me just lay these out quickly. You know, they argue for American hegemony, right? They want American to be aggressively active in the international system, smothering peer competitors, providing for collective defense for a whole array of globe-girdling allies. They oftentimes believe that we should actively spread our values abroad. We have to have a democracy promotion agenda. They're like the French revolutionaries, right? They think that the revolution can't be safe unless everyone looks like us. And then I want to say, like, well, who's us? You know, like, I'm not sure that Washington agrees with most people in this room about our domestic politics, right? And then, like, people like Bob Kagan and Bill Kristol, full up members of the foreign policy establishment, you know, they even say, like, hey, sometimes we have to pick wars just to basically, you know, show who's boss, right? To put down hostile ideologies or hostile dictators, even when you can't connect it to the national interest. They admitted that in print. And then in one piece that they wrote in 1996 that they very quickly tried to roll back in their rhetoric was that they also thought that, hey, they thought in the 90s the world was going to hell. It was like Britney Spears and people, you know, gyrating to, pop music. And they said, we need more virtue, and a robust foreign policy can give us more virtue. I'm serious. 1996, Foreign Affairs Magazine, they talk about that. Because they thought a lot of people were kind of not living their best life, and if they were committed to a big project, a big imperial project, they'd have a better life. Again, that's the way these people think. It's very different than the way I think. I'm a believer in restraint. And this is an up-and-coming foreign policy approach that particularly over the last, 6 to 10 years has really found its legs. It's becoming institutionalized in Washington. There's more excitement and energy around it. President Trump had some restraint instincts, like with getting out of Afghanistan, questioning the issue of our alliances abroad and whether they were pulling their weight. You know, there's some instincts there. But the two pillars of restraint are very much consistent with what George Washington talked about in the farewell address, right? Non-entanglement and a kind of defensive non-interventionism. Okay? It wasn't non-intervention purely, but this notion that we should avoid permanent peacetime alliances is a key part of restraint. And then, you know, you could form temporary alliances as needed, depending on the balance of power and the nature of the threat environment. So you might want to have allies, you know, during our fight for independence. You even might want to have alliances at the dawn of the Cold War, given the threat of Soviet communism. But today we would say, hey, it doesn't make sense for us, given our strategic position today. And then an approach that says, hey, let's rely on defense and deterrence, not interventionism. You know, so we ought to use the force abroad kind of minimally consistent with our national interest. Right, so if that means that there is a terrorist organization with the intent and capability to hit the United States and they're operating in Sudan or Afghanistan, well, we should whack them. Okay, we have the over-the-horizon capabilities to do that, again, assuming that they have the intent and capability to harm us. But it doesn't mean that you go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, as John Quincy Adams talked about. And again, given the nature of the world and our technologies, we can rely a lot on deterrence to keep ourselves safe and to protect what I talked about earlier as our national interests. You'd also want to have a strong Navy, a strong Air Force, a strong space capability to keep threats far from our shores. But we don't have to have a big army that's forward deployed, smothering other regimes, democracy promoting, and getting ourselves, frankly, over our skis and tumbling down the mountain like we have since the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Think about these interventions. Twice in Bosnia, Kosovo, the Iraq War, the biggest dumpster fire of my life, okay? Libya, which is an underrated debacle, right? Arms flowed out to other places, terrorists flowed in, you had civil wars, Mali next door was destabilized, requiring a French intervention, and then you promoted a refugee crisis that undermined stability in Europe. What's not to love, right? That's Obama's foreign policy, okay? Think about the Afghanistan Nation Building Project. You know, we're going to build girls' schools in Helmand. Somehow that's going to make people in Coos County safer? Give me a break. Show me the theory that doesn't rely on massive leaps of faith to get there. Now, again, I think that as realists, we have to understand that the world can be a dangerous place, and so we have to have a strong national defense. That's part of restraint. Restraint does not equal pacifism. It's rooted in realism about the nature of the world, realism about human nature. So we need to maintain strong national defense, but how we do it is important. Now, again, some people might not like this, but I think the Monroe Doctrine is a critical part of our defense posture. We have to make sure that we don't have foreign military powers cheek and jowl with the United States on our borders. Some people think that might be dangerous. And again, this view is rooted in realism. You can get there through libertarianism. My friend Chris Preble says that restraint is fully justified by a libertarian philosophy. Awesome, that's great. I love it. But you don't have to be a libertarian to also believe in restraint, because you can ground it in a kind of conception of that's been around for 2,500 years, the idea of realism, which I'll tell you a little later, I think dovetails actually with libertarianism, classical liberalism, and conservatism. So this is a case in which good things do go together. And a part of that is because we believe certain things about balancing behavior. Like if Russia, let's say we retrenched from Europe and Russia was aggressive, do you think Germany and Poland and Lithuania and Finland and the UK and France are all going to sit around like just taking it? I mean, France has nuclear weapons. How are the Russians going to get to the Dover Straits when France has nuclear weapons? Okay. And I'm assuming that they wouldn't like them to go through Belgium or the Netherlands either to get there, right? The nuclear revolution, I just mentioned it with France. Okay. Germany could easily have a nuclear capability. Okay. That would be a deterrent against the kind of aggression. So a famous international relations scholar, Ken Waltz, talked about how actually the slow spread of nuclear weapons, especially among technologically sophisticated states like Japan or Germany, right? This could actually bring greater great power peace. And you've actually seen that India-Pakistani relations, while always tense, they have not gone to war in terms of having a big conflagration since they both got nuclear weapons. Why? Because nuclear weapons sober you up really hard, right? Like it's the biggest sobriety-inducing thing in the world, I think. Maybe becoming a father or a mother. It's serious, right? And we also believe that security dilemmas are real. In other words, like when you do something in international politics, there's an action-reaction cycle. And so you have to worry that if you just say like, we just want to let Georgia into the alliance, into NATO, okay, that might be a good thing or a bad thing in a vacuum. But we also have to understand that that can promote fear on the other side, and that that could induce a kind of spiral, okay, an escalatory spiral. So we have to be careful about provoking what are called security dilemmas. Another thing that restrainers think is that alliances, while they may make sense in some circumstances, have lots of pathologies. One of these is that you can get chain-ganged, right? Has anybody seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Love that movie. Remember when George Clooney gets like pulled out of the train by the other people on the chain gang? He doesn't want to be thrown off the train, but he gets pulled by his allies. That happens in international politics. Okay. I'm deathly afraid that we are going to get chain ganged into a war that many of us don't want by our partnership with Ukraine and our alliance with places like Poland. Buck passing. I think the United States is the only country that doesn't understand that at least today, that it makes sense to buck pass. Unfortunately, we're the ones that are getting the buck passed to us. Germany spends 1.2 to 1.4% of GDP on its defense. They should be spending a lot more on that, particularly if they believe what we believe about the threat. But again, they're buck passing, so they're kind of like, we're the suckers. As one of my friends calls us, Uncle Sucker. Now, I love our country, but we get played a lot by foreign countries. And then the issue of moral hazard, right? I work at the American Institute for Economic Research. Moral hazard is an important concept in political economy, and we've seen this over and over again. You could argue that some of the problems we've seen in Eastern Europe is because of moral hazard, okay? Particularly in the case of Georgia. And then there's this whole problem of primacy, which is that oftentimes the argument is something like, you have to go to war to prevent a war. It has a kind of lack of humility about knowing the future that all libertarians reject, right? I mean, Hayek, The Use of Knowledge in Society, one of the greatest pieces ever written, talks about the problem of knowledge, the knowledge problem, right? Now again, he's talking mostly about different issues, but that knowledge problem, or what he calls the fatal conceit, applies to us too, right? Preventive war is premised on the idea that you could see far into the future and actually have certainty about what's going to happen. We don't have that type of certainty. But primacists want us to fight wars because they know if we don't, right? As Bob Kagan talks about, the jungle will grow back. His whole premise of his recent book was that we have to just hack away at this jungle that keeps growing back unless the United States adopts a primacist approach to the world. As if Germany and France are simply going to let bad things happen around them, right, if we don't do it for them, right? It's nuts. And then, like I said, the biggest threat to our interests, honestly, are here at home. Overreaching government, debt and deficits, and the taxes that come from them, whether now or on our kids. These are the things that really imperil us, not to mention other things in our domestic politics, like the culture wars, which are real. You might not want to fight them, but they're fighting you. Okay, these are really bad problems. Foreign policy isn't going to help. Now, I would argue that whether you're a conservative, a classical liberal, or a libertarian, that this realist logic that I've laid out, we're kissing cousins. Why? Because we have very consistent, I think, views about idealism, that idealism is dangerous. Having certain assumptions about human nature that are too rosy, that's dangerous. Having a conceit about our ability to know, right? Madeleine Albright, when she was Secretary of State, said, "The United States stands taller and sees further." That's hubris, right? And by the way, if she did and they do in Washington, why have we gotten into so many losing conflicts? We should have stood taller and seen further and saw that this was a mess. That we couldn't have, you know, liberalism in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, or that we couldn't continue to send our alliance structure further and further east without stimulating the security dilemma. The other thing, and again, particularly for those of you who are conservatives, right, war upsets patterns. Now, as a classical liberal and a libertarian, I'm less worried about this, right, because capitalism also upsets patterns. But for conservatives, they worry about patterns being upset, and even Hayekian classical liberals would say so, because certain traditions, right, are incentive compatible in a way. But war upsets them, and war is the health of the state. If there's anything that war is, it is the seedbed of government growth. And this is what always troubles me about libertarian imperialists. And there may be some of you out there, and feel free to ask questions. But the problem with libertarian imperialism seems to me, all the way back to Mill, all the way to all the libertarians who supported the Iraq War, or even some libertarians who are so gung-ho to fight the war of autocracy against democracy today, is that war really is the health of the state. There's a guns and butter trade-off. Taxation, debt, deficits, right? The trade-offs that Democrats and Republicans make to keep increasing the defense budget means, because of our understanding of public choice theory, that you're going to see Democrats trying to cut a deal for increased social spending. So the government keeps growing. Not to mention the surveillance state that we saw. I mean, after 9/11, we saw a massive increase in government surveillance. You have things like the Patriot Act and other ways that are restricting our freedom. And it centralizes power. Okay. So I think that for lots of reasons, including the idea that social engineering at home or abroad is a bad idea, means that classical liberals, realists, libertarians, and conservatives should all, I think, get behind this approach to foreign policy. So let me talk now about Ukraine, because I've spent a lot of time talking about the context, because Ukraine fits within the context of this overall critique of primacy and this argument for restraint. Foreign policy for any country, related to any country, should not be in a vacuum. It should be related to a larger strategic theory. And what I would say is, and again, I've been to Ukraine before, okay, I have great sympathy for the suffering of Ukrainians. It's a complete red herring when people say that those who oppose U.S. intervention in this conflict, like Putin or like Russia or are callous, that is not the case. One of the reasons why I would like a change in American foreign policy is because I do think it would be better for many parts of the world. It would also be best for the United States. But the fact is that Ukraine does not implicate American vital national interests in any significant way other than one, which is, we don't want to have a nuclear conflict with Russia. That's the one thing that could really impinge on our future, to say the least. So we have to worry about an escalatory spiral with Russia. So even if we really wanted to do certain things, and even if we believed everything we've heard about Ukraine, it's still very dangerous to push too hard and too heavy, because you could get an escalatory spiral that could lead to a nuclear conflict. That's the thing we should avoid. But outside of the nuclear issue, and again, as a realist, you just look at the world as it is. This is just the way it is. It sucks to be in a bad neighborhood. But the fact is that Russia doesn't pose a significant threat to U.S. vital interests, other than the one I talked about. Okay? Russia's economy is mid-major. It has the economy of like roughly Spain or Italy. I'm not worried about Spain or Italy. Even if they weren't our allies, I wouldn't worry about it. Okay? They just can't produce a lot of economic power. Two, Russia's military has been shown not to be very strong. Now, again, I've been writing about Ukraine for years and years and years and saying this, so I'm not a Johnny-come-lately, but what we've seen in Ukraine has shown that Russia is no threat to be marching through the Champs-Élysées. Okay? They have a hard time projecting power. They have corruption. They have logistical problems. They have a lot of artillery, and they can engage that way. But still, this is not a country that is a major threat to Western Europe. And again, even if they were, how are they going to do the swim? How do they get... Remember during the Obama administration, they tried to sail a ship through the Mediterranean, and it looked like it was going to like sink on the way there. Right? They're not a significant naval power. So Russia is a threat to its neighbors, there's no doubt, but it's not a threat to the United States in the same way, and so we have to calibrate our response to that. Third, NATO can depend on deterrence and defense. Okay, so I remember this history in which Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, our biggest geostrategic threat in our history, maybe. And who won the Cold War? We did, right? We won the Cold War, even under the worst case scenario. So I think we could depend on deterrence and defense. And I don't think the US-NATO approach to Russia is supporting our interests. Okay, the economic costs to Europe alone are quite high. I was just in Europe, okay? And the fact is that they're suffering greatly from some of these economic challenges posed by this war. Number two is it's expensive. We're spending upwards of $113 billion on this, and that's just to get where we are today. That's just the United States. And there's always, always opportunity costs. You lose your economic card if you don't think about opportunity cost. We're also doing a reverse Kissinger. We're pushing China and Russia together. If you thought the nuclear revolution was bollocks, right? The nuclear revolution doesn't actually exist. The one big threat traditionally Americans have worried about is a Eurasian hegemon, right? One country or coalition of countries dominating from the Dover Straits all the way to the Sea of Japan. And Kissinger was brilliant in splitting the Sino-Soviet alliance. We're helping push it back together. That's dumb. I talked about stimulating the security dilemma, but also I think that American behavior, NATO's behavior, has actually hurt democratic forces inside the former Soviet Union. So that's not wise, even if you want to see the spread of greater liberalism abroad. I also think that the arguments in favor of us getting into the war or being so heavily involved as an assistance partner are relatively weak. And I wrote a piece recently for Reason Magazine. I don't know if there's any Reasonistas in the crowd, but thanks for publishing that. But I wrote a piece for Reason Magazine, and I talked about how, in part, the arguments in favor of the war and for increasing support for the war are weak. So one argument is that, like, look, this is a reasonable cost to bleed the Russians dry. Well, for one thing, if you care about Ukrainians, then you're being really cynical. I mean, like, that's even, like, hyper-realism, even for me. But if you were a realist saying that, I might be able to understand it, right? You know, it's Nazis and Soviets fighting each other. You kind of get that. But if you're really a humanitarian and care about Ukrainian lives, you're basically saying, like, hey, The Russians aren't that much of a threat, but we're going to bleed them to make them even less of a threat, and we're going to do it by the killing of thousands and thousands of Ukrainians in the interstices, right? And I've already talked about why this isn't necessary, because they're not that much of a threat. Escalatory risk is too high, and again, I talked about that cynicism. So I don't think the bleed Russia thing is a great argument. And again, $113 billion is not nothing, and that's just the start. Other people would say, well, we have to support the sovereignty norm. There was aggression by Russia against Ukraine. Okay, I get it. I think the sovereignty norm is something that on the margins is valuable. But look, we should rely on hard power, not on a norm, right? A norm, a piece of paper, Article 51 of the UN Charter, right? Like, these things are probably worth as much as the ink they're written on, okay? If you want to ask about sovereignty, ask Syria, ask Iraq, ask other places, right? Ask Georgia, right? Sovereignty is frequently breached in international relations. It's why you have to rely on hard power. So have a strong national defense. That's the way to protect yourself. And the United States hasn't taken sovereignty seriously over the last 30 years, okay? And then this issue of supporting liberalism. Well, look, as I laid out before, there's moral dignity in the government protecting our national interests. If it goes beyond that, it's going too far. It's violating classical liberal norms. So if we're going to defend liberalism by violating the principles of liberalism here at home, well, that's not really supporting liberalism. Not to mention the fact that Ukraine isn't a paragon of liberalism. Is it a better place than Russia? Does it have a better government than Russia? Is Zelensky better than Putin? Yes. Okay, I don't like to hear people on my side making a positive claim about Russia. Russia's a bad place. And again, I don't like that language because it sounds Manichaean. Let's just say it's worse than many other countries around the world. And Putin's a bad guy. Okay, he's admittedly a bad guy. But most state leaders in history have been bad guys. Doesn't mean you have to go to war with them all the time. But Ukraine isn't a paragon of liberalism. And I could go on and on about that, but I'm going to hold that for maybe for Q&A. So thank you. We have some time for Q&A, about 15 minutes if we need it, but thank you. All right, any questions? Please come up to... War is a racket. Well, I said war is the health of the state. That's pretty close to that. But yeah, I mean, look, I didn't talk about Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech, right? Eisenhower was right. The military-industrial complex is real. I don't, however, think that our foreign policy is so screwed up merely because of the military-industrial complex. It's worse than that and more dangerous. It's that primacy that I talked about earlier is a set of ideas that dominates the foreign policy establishment on both the Republican and Democratic side. That's the biggest danger, and the military-industrial complex is more than happy to help support that. It's a Baptist and bootlegger coalition. But yes, it often is a racket. Yes?
So I think you made a good argument for as to why the United States shouldn't get involved. I guess my question would be for some of like the smaller ex-Soviet socialist republics, do you think they should be more involved for their own safety?
Well, again, if I were an advisor to the prince of my country, right, if I'm going to be an advisor, I usually say that referencing Machiavelli, but maybe I should say it because remember Biden said God save the queen for some unknown reason. But if you're advising your government, I think you should focus on what you think is in its interests. But again, if you're asking me as a kind of analyst, well, I think the question depends, right? Like one, buck passing is underrated. Poles should want Ukrainians to die to promote Polish security more than Poles. And that sounds hardcore, but look, that's what we did at the beginning of World War II. We let the Soviets basically bear most of the brunt of the conflict. And buck passing is underrated, okay? And you could buck pass to states that have a greater interest in something. Now, again, if I'm a neighbor of Russia, given what I've just said about Russia, yeah, I think you should be concerned. But that doesn't automatically implicate people in Des Moines, Iowa, okay? Now, Finland, I think that, you know, Finland is like a porcupine, not in the sense of you guys, but is kind of a porcupine, and so that's what it's done to protect itself over time. And I think that if you're a state on the boundaries of some of these countries like Russia, and China, yes, you should try to make yourself a porcupine. Or maybe, just maybe, you should form regional alliances that don't implicate the United States. So has anybody heard of the Brookings Institute? Right, the Brookings Institution? So when I worked at Coke, I funded a study there years and years ago calling for a new architecture for Eastern Europe that didn't include NATO, written by Mike O'Hanlon. Mike O'Hanlon is nowhere close to being a restrainer or someone who isn't part of the foreign policy establishment. He's on the 50-yard line of the foreign policy establishment, and even he thought years ago that we should have a different security architecture. And by we, I think he meant them. So yes, they should do more to do this. And again, I think traditionally Americans relied on other countries taking care of their neighborhoods or dealing with problems in their neighborhoods. We didn't always have to be at the front. And so restraint is really just harkening back to a long American tradition of grand strategy, and I want to return to that. I think it served us very well. And it also was coterminous probably with our most classical liberal moment as a country. Thank you.
Hey there, I'm Taras, and my family's ethnically Ukrainian, but I got born on the Russian side. Basically, my perspective that I want to add is that during the Soviet period, there was just massive killing going on by the Soviet government towards its own citizens in Russia and Ukraine and all over the republics. And politicians weren't taking it seriously, and neither were, you know, journalists. So I don't feel like we can rely on either of those forces in general to help people out. But what about evacuating people who need help in Ukraine, in Russia, in various situations in the world? North Korea is a big example. How do you how do you help people get out of those bad situations while also not creating a security risk in countries that they're fleeing to?
Yeah, no, it's a tricky issue, right? It's I think different for Ukraine than it was for example, Afghanistan, where you had a greater threat that people could use this avenue that weren't well-intentioned. You know, but I do think that these kind of non-military assistance levers would be effective at remedying some of the human cost of the conflict, so supporting refugees and whatnot. Now, again, if you're a Ukrainian patriot or Ukrainian nationalist, if I were stepping in your shoes, I would be a little worried about that because you don't want fighting-age men in particular, but also women now, to leave your country en masse because you're going to face a manpower problem. So this is where you can see an unintended consequence of being a humanitarian. Again, if you assume that this is the most crucial fight, you wouldn't necessarily want to see that. My own druthers is I would like to see people respond to that humanitarian catastrophe that has resulted from this horrible war. As for like bad things happening in bad places, again, I think that we should shine a light on it. I think journalism is important. I think the using our kind of bully pulpit, we can say what's bad in the world. Again, I think we should be careful at that. You know, we do have to satisfy our interests. It's sometimes you can actually backfire in this way. So I know some people who are always excited about the idea of smuggling like zip drives into other countries with freedom techs. I always worry about unintended consequences of that. Like, are people going to get killed if you do that? To me, that's a prudential thing, not a principled one, right? I think that a do no harm approach in these areas is oftentimes important to keep in mind. And again, like realism is not an approach that says we shouldn't be horrified by the war crimes and misdeeds of people in our world. This is one of the reasons why we hate big tyrannical government as classical liberals, libertarians, conservatives, right? Because we see the evil that can be done by government, particularly when it's done by governments. So I will stand behind no one in hating Stalinism, Nazism, and tyranny. But the question is how do you prudentially respond to avoid a nuclear conflict or a World War III scenario? And that's where I think realism is a corrective to kind of ideological thinking. Thank you. Tony.
Hello, good to see you again. I missed the very beginning, so if you covered this, I apologize. But my take for quite a while on the Ukraine situation is that it's a almost classical example of escalatory cycle caused by primacy, and that's at least to some extent what led to this whole thing, and we just keep doing it.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a big fight, and a lot of people that are very much supportive of America's current approach to the war in Ukraine has been to say, hey, we need to stop talking about the causes of this, because the causes of it are Putin and Russian nationalism, and you guys complaining about the open door policy and all that stuff need to shut up and just get on board. And I actually think that the causes of the conflict need to be discussed, because I think it helps us figure out a way out. I do think it would be too simple to say that there's a unicause, right? That the only cause of this was NATO's open door and us pushing, okay? But I do think it was a necessary, even if insufficient, cause. That if the United States had been willing to say, because again, NATO isn't the United States, but it might as well be. It's a kind of security condominium. We're the most important country in it. If the United States just said, look, we want to de-escalate relations here, and we're closing NATO's open door, does that mean that everything was going to be rosy in Eastern Europe? No. But do I think that that could have a peace-inducing effect? Yes.
Yeah, thank you. And one of the reasons I really have a problem with this, don't worry about how we got here, is that we're just going to do the similar things again. We need to think about it.
Yeah, and I always talk about Ukraine and Georgia both going hand in hand here, because remember, there was a war with Russia and Georgia in 2008. And that also related to this. And I've written a lot on the background of this. But look, we've been doing military-to-military exercises with these countries. Okay, we've had important American officials. Mike Pence went there. Mike Pompeo went there. And they talked about how, well, you guys are practically part of NATO already. We were practically defending your sovereignty, right? That creates moral hazard, or the potential for moral hazard. It changes the nature of how that interaction goes, and it can lead to escalatory spirals built on security dilemmas. So again, I agree with you. Harold and Kumar.
Hi there. Hey. Could you speak at all to the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines as a potential ploy to chain gang the rest of Europe onto the Ukrainian side of the conflict by sort of preempting the possibility of neutrality in exchange for continued access to Russian energy?
Yeah. I guess what I would say, to be careful, we don't know for sure who blew up the pipeline. I think that just like a good lawyer, you should always ask yourself, qui bono, who benefits, right? And to me, I think that I was always dubious. I was never certain that the official story was true, just from what I read of the New York Times and other places, because it seemed to me that those who benefited were actually the Ukrainian side of things, right? I would be hesitant to have certainty about it, but I think that there are very reasonable arguments for why it might not have been Russia that did this. Now, if it wasn't Russia that did this, that implicates something different, right? Like, this was a project that was jointly done by Russia and our allies. And so let's just take for the sake of argument that if the Ukrainians did it, this is an attack by Ukraine, especially if it had a connection with the government, on the interests of our allies and partners. You'd think we might be more interested in that issue. All right, next.
Hi, my name is Stefano. First of all, I'd like to commend you for coming over here and talking about the initiation of force to a group of people who have pretty strong opinions about it.
And lots of guns.
And lots of guns. This is true.
I'm unarmed, except
for thank you for being here and doing the speech. I was just wondering, what do you think of proxy wars and how the U.S. has visibly use proxy wars as a way to engage in warfare with other countries?
Yeah.
Specifically, Ukraine is, to my eyes, a very obvious proxy war with Russia.
Yeah. So again, as a realist, I would never say never when it comes to proxy wars, okay? I think if the circumstances are such that you're worried about another country, there are ways in which you can do that short of direct engagement that might be better than direct engagement. So I wouldn't always be opposed to proxy wars. What I would say, though, is that unfortunately, we have internalized the notion that we're basically an unsafe country, that there are threats everywhere, and we have to go abroad to kill these monsters. And I just have a different conception of the threat environment. And if you have a different conception of that threat environment, it means that that doing proxy wars aren't necessarily as important as they might be if there were a lot more threats. Right, so if it's Nazi Germany, it's 1939, and nukes don't exist yet, and you're worried about the Eurasian balance of power, then you might want to fight a proxy war or even a direct war. But today, it's not 1938 or 1939 or 1941 today, and that's why I think we have to look at that context. Where's my friend who's running the show here? Do I have time for any more questions?
Probably not.
I'm happy to talk with you afterwards, but thank you for coming, and hopefully this was useful.